A red Z slashes a black background, followed by white script. Zeitgeist Films, The Spirit of the Times. A cracked blacktop road runs through arid hills toward a white sun perched on the low horizon. Words appear. In the fall of 2012, freelance journalist Theo Padnos traveled to Syria to report on the country's civil war. He slipped through the border from Turkey with local guides. A thin man with curly brown hair walks through a narrow doorway into a plain, small room.
They brought me into a room like this. And, you know, that was just a mattress on the ground. Three of them sat down on a bed that was right here. And I sat down on a mattress like this.
He sits on the floor by a window.
There was three of them over there. And the fourth came over and sat down next to me here. And they said, why don't you do an interview with this guy here? They set up a tripod with their little camera. They told me that they had worked as journalists on behalf of the Free Syrian Army. So I figured perhaps they're filming something that they can use in some later film clip or something. And this guy, I asked him questions like, what was the happiest day of the war for you? What was the saddest? What made you participate in the revolution? Questions like that for 20 minutes. And I looked at him at the end and I go, I'm done. I don't have any more questions. I looked at the guys with the camera.
He indicates the bed.
And one of them stood up, he goes, Yalla ya Shabab, should we go, boys? And all three stood up. They walked over to me. And one guy kicked me right really hard in the face like this. My head jerked back. And then they're all stamping on me and kicking on me and jumping on me. And then I heard somebody say, put on the handcuffs. Put on the handcuffs. They cuffed me behind my back like this. And then they tied my legs up. And they said, we're from the Al-Qaeda organization, the name Al-Qaeda, and you're our prisoner now. Then they all started laughing. You know, they thought it was the funniest thing in the world. I'm thinking, I committed suicide, but I'm still alive.
Words appear. Theo who lived. Barefoot, Theo climbs a bare sandy hill overlooking foothills in the distance. Antakya, Turkey. He rides in the back of a car on a four-lane city road. He looks out the windows.
This is where I threw my life away. I'm just getting over that. This is like the precipice that I walked up to, and then I actually jumped. And now I'm back in a safe place. I'm thinking, why did I ever jump? That's so crazy, so stupid. Syrians use this city, Antakya. It's like a rear camp for their revolution. All the Al-Qaeda guards, they would say, oh, I gotta go up to Turkey today. Goodbye, I gotta go to Turkey. What are you doing? Oh, I'm just buying some supplies. Because the border is so porous, and I'm sure it still is so porous. So I'm anticipating seeing some of my old Jibbeth and Nusra buddies walking around buying shampoo. You know, they gotta take care of their hair. It'd be interesting to see who we see.
A narrow drive twists up a hill between rough two-story buildings.
I was living through some hard times financially when I was here. So I met this Tunisian guy. We each paid $20 a month, and this is where I lived.
A house with dirty walls.
In this house, this is like Auberge Espagnole of all the different factions of the war in Syria. Two people here, they lived in a room from the Free Syrian Army. Next door to them lived people who supported the regime. And next door here lived one guy from Jabhat al-Nusra. That shows you the frivolity of this war that's happening down there, because they can all live in the same house and get along and respect one another, provided you bring them into Turkey. But if you have them down there, they'll cut off each other's heads and kill each other.
A man reaches into a pouch. Subtitles. Look, I still have your SIM cards.
Wow. You know, I have SIM cards from like 25 different countries here. I was like a homeless journalist traveling around.
Theo walks through a crowded bazaar.
In Syria, you're living in this whole field of secret symbols. People wearing little lockets, people wearing their hair a certain way, they wear their veil a certain way. And they're broadcasting messages about their religious identity. At the time, there was a huge community of journalists here in Antakya. And I thought, they don't really understand these religious codes. And furthermore, they can't speak a language. They're just at sea. Me, I can swim in the ocean.
Two young women pass Theo. One carries a cell phone. A toddler rides on a woman's back. Theo climbs a steep hill on cement steps.
I would walk up here every day. I would think, am I really going to go south into those killing fields for $500? And I thought, I'll write a lovely piece for the New Yorker. I mean, the New Republic. I could have never gotten in the New Yorker. And my journalism career will prosper.
He strolls on a stone path overlooking a sprawling city.
I have been a risk taker. When I was younger, in my 20s, I spent a lot of time rock climbing. This alarmed my mom because her brother was killed in a rock climbing accident in the 50s. When I left for Syria, mom was like, you're still in this place where you gotta do stuff that hurts me and do stuff that might get yourself killed. Why do you need to do this?
A flock of white birds rises above the hill.
I was sitting on this rock right here. I had some self-esteem issues because I was having so little career success. I was looking at the ants and I'm going...
Black ants scurry at his feet.
The ant has a more interesting life than me. It's just 2 days and I'm not that much of a chicken. I mean, I'm a tough guy. I can handle it. And I looked at the ants some more. And then without really thinking about it, I stood up and walked down and went to meet the people who kidnapped me at the hotel.
They told me they were university students. They spoke proper, well-educated Arabic. I trusted them.
Outside the hotel aircon.
And they turned up right on time. So did I, and off we went. It's very reliable kidnappers. I understood that I was going to follow some refugees back into Syria, and that I was going to write about the adverse conditions in the camps.
A red flag with a white crescent and star waves above an intersection.
My kidnapper's house is like 200 meters over to the left here.
Theo strides down a narrow residential street.
We came here and had tea and hung out until the sun was about to go down so that we could sneak into Syria in the darkness.
He gazes at a black door at the top of 8 steps.
Anyway, there they live, you know, we can knock on the door and say, hi, remember me? I'm the guy you kidnapped. How's it going? They tortured me too, these guys. They live right here, they're part of my torture. So it'd be nice if we could just have some kind of reckoning or accounting. But nobody seems interested in pursuing them except us. FBI said, well, we communicate our intelligence to Turkey. It's up to them. There's clearly some kind of hornet's nest they don't want to put their hands in here.
The door opens slowly.
Now they all know we're here.
Theo turns to his left, looking down the street. 2 dark-haired young men walk toward him. Subtitles. Peace be upon you. Just a question. Do you live here? Do you live in the apartment on the left? Is it okay if I translate?
They say that they live in this apartment, and the people that lived here beforehand, they left, and now it's these guys, and they didn't know the people who were here before.
Do you work with the Free Syrian Army?
Mm-hmm.
As a fighter? A bit, yeah? You too? I was studying at the University of Aleppo, and then I was drafted by the army, but I wasn't going to fight for them.
They're both, you know, working with the resistance in Syria. And, you know, I asked him what he wanted to do with Bashar, Bastimsiku. He said, I want to do lots of things. Okay.
All right. Thank you. I hope to see you in the future. He shakes their hands. They go inside.
They were nice young men, just like my kidnappers, those two. And I felt like the friendship that I began with them here, if I had gotten in a car with them, it could continue.
A car moves through a flat, open area with alternating dark earth and verdant fields.
Oh, that is serious. Oh, that is serious, serious, serious.
Theo rubs his lower lip with a knuckle. Shredded plastic hangs on a barbed wire fence.
They brought me along this road. They had me pick my things out of the trunk, and as soon as I had my backpack in my hand, they go, run!
Wearing a blue backpack, Theo runs through orchards of widely spaced trees.
In subsequent months, it was the enthusiasm and the speed with which I ran that came back to me. You're running to your death, you stupid idiot. How could you do this so voluntarily? I mean, I actually physically sprinted into the death zone. Suddenly, there was a barbed wire in front of me, and we all jumped over the fence.
Theo falls to his knees, jumps back up, and continues. Behind him, the land stretches in a variegated patchwork of greens.
It occurred to me, now we're in Syria.
He sits on the floor by the window.
The first thing they talked to me about as soon as they had me in cuffs was the aggression and the horrible things that America has done in the past. They brought up the slaughter of the American Indians, like, right away. They brought up Hiroshima in those first 5 minutes. What did you do to the Japanese? I'm like, I wasn't alive, I'm sorry. They started pouring water over me. This is Guantanamo, 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 Guantanamo. And then they had these cables, these steel cables there.
He stands.
Whack, whack, with the cables, whack against my hands, against my head. I'm like bleeding all down my head. Whack, whack, whack.
He swings his arm.
Yeah, I was screaming at the top of my lungs, but we were out in an olive grove somewhere.
Outside the window, scrubby bushes punctuate a steep hill.
They had cut my face. I was bleeding from my face. So one of the chiefs said, go get him a washcloth and let him wash his face a little bit. And they very gently washed my face and staunched the bleeding a little bit. And then they ordered takeaway chicken and brought it in and had lunch.
He smiles slightly and looks down.
There was an incredible thunderstorm that night, and there was also all kinds of artillery fire.
At dusk, a two-story building is missing the front walls. Rubble litters the ground.
During the night, I kept asking the guy, can you undo my handcuffs so I can get up and go pee? I really need to pee. Peeing like four or five times during this night. And maybe the fifth time, when he put the handcuffs back on me, he put them really loose. They were loose enough so I could slip out. So I waited for this guy to sleep. I could hear him. And I very quietly pulled my hand out of the handcuffs. And I stood up as if I was going to the bathroom. I stepped over his body, sleeping. I took two steps towards the door and I looked back. They're both sleeping. And I ran out the door.
A full moon hovers above silhouetted trees.
I was terrified. I was shaking. I had never been so frightened in my life. And I stopped the car. I said, you gotta take me to the Free Syrian Army. Take me to the Free Syrian Army. The guy was like, okay, okay. He drove me and I kissed his hand. I said, thank you. Kissed his hand like it showed subservience and submission to this guy. He took me down. He goes, that black door over there. I ran up to the black door. I'm in, I'm a journalist, help me, help me, help me. I thought the kidnappers were running after me. So I entered into their little police station, they're all asleep. I hid under their beds. That's what I'm afraid. They said, what are you doing? You're under your safety now. You're with us, you're with the Free Syrian Army, it's safe. So eventually I sat up on top of their beds and they were listening to Fairuz and having a nice time. We had tea and falafel and everything came back to normal.
A pinpoint of white in a pink sky, the sun rises.
The kidnapper turned up at the police station. They had an argument for a little while, and then my kidnappers were standing in front of me. They said, come here, come with us. They all had guns, you know, they had their handguns out like this. And they threw me in the back of a large truck.
At a checkpoint, an armed man looks in the cab of a truck.
I heard them talking to a checkpoint, and suddenly, on the far side of the checkpoint, the guy hit the gas,
Armed men in masks wave at the truck.
They're so happy to get their American.
Theo rides in the back.
And they started singing, "Our front is victorious."
Subtitles. Salam to al-Nusra, who are victorious over the unbelievers. An automatic weapon sits on the dashboard. They drive through empty streets. Subtitles. Jabhat al-Nusra is victorious.
And I was like into Al-Qaeda land at that point.
Bombed buildings stand next to whole ones. Black smoke rises in the distance. Mist drifts across a lake ringed by pines. On a hill stands a large white colonial house with dark shutters. A white-haired woman sits on a couch.
I had been so used to Theo living in Yemen and living in Damascus.
Nancy Curtis.
But I hadn't done the kinds of things that
Theo's mother.
If you have a younger child, you know, I want a contact number. But at the time he went in, there were a lot of journalists going into Syria at that time, going in and coming out. And it looked as if the FSA was gaining ground, and it looked as if the FSA were the good guys. Theo was in the process of buying me a new wood stove. So every day we were having this exchange about, did we want this one or did we want that one? He was answering me right away, and then there came a day when he didn't get back to me right away.
Dark clouds gather.
I wrote, "Here we have a big storm approaching. It's been more than a week since I had any news. Please do tell me what's up. Sorry, but worrying is my job."
She holds a white dog on her lap.
"Love, Mom."
In the dark, the windows glow warmly.
Outside, the storm was raging and the trees were going all over the place. Everybody was supposed to stay home because of the danger of being out of doors. I got an email from Theo. The subject line was, "Hey." It sounded like Theo, but there was no message.
Lightning illuminates the trees.
What I immediately thought was that he had gone to an internet cafe to send me a message and that there had been a bomb or he had been arrested. And I was all alone and frantic.
A woman with long dark hair, Viva, Theo's cousin.
I was just passing an apple tree that had a huge limb sheared off of it. It was on the ground. And my phone rang, and it was Nancy, and she said, "I've been trying to call you at home. I couldn't reach you." And I said, "Yes, our phone is out. Tell me." And I immediately sensed something in her voice, this rivulet of anxiety that I picked up on right away.
And I immediately started to cry. And she said, "What's happened to Theo?"
In the Syrian city, black debris shoots high into the air. In a dark room, Theo sits on the floor.
This place was clearly under attack. Bombs, shelling, bombs, fighting, firefights, the middle of a war zone. And there'd be people down the hall being tortured. I'm like, this is gonna be ugly when they finally kill me. I felt that only people from Al-Qaeda go to this place. And nobody comes back. Every time I had a chance to relax, I'm like, this isn't happening. This isn't happening. When I was sleeping, it wasn't happening because I was home at home in Vermont. Everything was fine. And then I wake up, nightmare. I would wake into a nightmare every morning. So I tried to sleep as much as possible.
The smoke drifts over the city. Daytime. At the house, rain drips from the trees.
I called the local Boston FBI and I said, "My son is a journalist, is missing in Syria." And the guy who answered the phone said, "Lady, that's a dangerous place. What's he doing there?" I said, "Well, he's a writer, he's writing about it." "Well, I didn't ask him to go there. What do you expect me to do?"
A photograph, Betsy, Viva, Amy.
There was a team of three
Theo's cousins.
Extraordinary people in my family. And they took it on as their full-time job, after their other jobs, to find Theo.
In the early days, the three of us were contacting everybody that we could think of in the journalism world, any connection that we had in the government and aid agencies. Nobody knew what had happened, and that waiting, that watching, that hoping, it was such a difficult time.
They were so cruel to me, especially at first. I was terrified of my guards. They wanted me to be in terror, you know? Their specialty is just keeping you in a state of constant terror. The guy that I was afraid of, he hadn't really hit me much, but he had been very abrupt and cruel in his speech to me. He said, as soon as you hear my key in the door, face to the wall. My face is to the wall, my face is to the wall. Boom. He whacked me in the back. I'm sorry, my face to the wall. Boom. I kept putting my face in the wall and he kept hitting me. I said, what are you doing, Sheikh? And he goes, I'm training your soul. One day he came in and he goes, prepare yourself to be executed in the Islamic manner in 5 minutes. And I thought, gee, that's not good. He left and he came back 5 minutes later with two kids and they handcuffed me and put me in blindfold. And they brought me down to the room of death. The room of death is the torture room. I don't know if they were killing people in there or not. I know they were torturing people in there. On the way to the room of death, he brought me into the bathroom and there was a room, there was a window at the kind of high up in the bathroom. He goes, look out this window. Out there is the sun. This is the last time you'll see the sun. Do you understand? I said, yes. When you walked in, you saw the chains that they used to whip people with, the handcuffs and the cables and the electricity, the batteries and ropes.
Theo walks up to a noose that hangs from the beams.
Something like this. Thank you. And they had me stand on a little stepladder.
He steps on a stool.
I felt this noose come down over my head, you know, like this. And I felt him tightening it, like this.
He puts it around his neck.
He snugged it right up like this. You know, but my hands were back here tied like this. And I was trying not to fall over, because if you fall over and you're... like, I could die right now. He's like walking around on the ground in front of me, like on the walking around among the boilers and the chains and the handcuffs and everything. The two kids are on either side of me. One of them whispers, goes in English, he goes, we kill you. We kill you now.
Dust swirls in the dim light.
The guy goes, you want to save your life? I say, yes, yes, save life. He goes, then you'll admit you're CIA. I said, but I'm not CIA. He goes, CIA agents don't confess, do they? I go, but I'm not CIA. I'm not. He goes, tell me how you got to Syria. And I said, airplane. Where did you fly out of? Montreal. He goes, are the girls prettier there? I go, it's the same. He goes, where did you fly to? Istanbul. Why Istanbul? Cheapest. Do you know any women in Istanbul? I said, yes, one. What's her name? Inchi. Did you sleep with her? No. Liar. He goes, do you know any women in Syria? Yes. What are their names? I told him their names. Did you sleep with them? No. It was like this for 40 minutes about my sex life. And then we heard somebody called the prayer in the hallway. And he took the noose off. And I backed down and I was alive again.
He removes the noose.
Then they put me back in my cell, and the next day they came and the real torture began. When they do an official torture thing, they lock you into a tire like this. They put a used tire, around your knees, and then they put a stick through here, like underneath your knees, and over the sidewalls of the tire, so you can't straighten your legs. And then they roll you over, so you're like this, on the ground.
On his stomach.
And then they just start hitting you, mostly on the soles of your feet, but, you know, across the back of your head, across your back, across your hands. It was just like this. And the one guy is kind of, you can see him, and he's just walking around, really mellow, asking questions. And the other, and, you know, maybe get five or six kids hitting you. Little kids, like some of them are 10 years old.
A boy sings for the camera.
I'd never lie.
They take metal rods, bits of rebar, or they take cable, like heavy gauge steel cable with a barbed end. So that as they hit you, the barb will wrap around your flesh and dig in.
Subtitles. Slaughter will come for you. With no agreement, slaughter will come for you. Without any truce.
Allahu Akbar! I didn't believe that I was gonna see my mom again. And I wanted to see her. Well, she came to me in my dreams.
Nancy stands by the fire.
There was one time where I saw her in my dream and I said, Mom, it's really bad here. And she said, I know. And I said, Mom, it's really bad, and the other thing is I'm not coming home. She said, it's okay.
He swallows and bites his fingernail.
I mean, after it was just seemed to be getting worse and worse and worse. And I was in this nether world that was only cruelty. And one day during a torture session, they said, if you don't confess to being CIA, we're gonna kill you under torture. And I confessed, like, CIA. But the guy told me tomorrow after the torture session, he goes, the one tomorrow is gonna be worse. And I thought, I know a way out of this. And they had given me a bandana. So I tied this clove hitch around my neck. Then I went up to the doorknob and I tied another clove hitch around the doorknob. I sunk my weight into the bandana, into this noose that I had created. And I tried to go to sleep. And I sort of lost consciousness for a second, just hanging from the doorknob. And I woke up like, oh my God, I'm hanging myself. What the fuck am I doing?
Snow covers the ground and lawn chairs by the lake.
That first winter, it was bleak. Really, really bleak. We explored every avenue that we could think of. It was as if the four of us were on the shore, and we were picking up bottles and stuffing messages in them and throwing them out into the Atlantic and hoping that just one of them reached somewhere near him and that somehow we would find out something. And we didn't for a very long time.
I think I spent much of the succeeding 22 months kind of in an emotional dead zone. Can't deal with it, put it away, lock the door. And get on with your daily life.
She chops an onion.
And the daily life is what sustains you. A month after Theo was taken, James Foley was taken.
The Today Show.
So we just ask his captors to recognize his innocence and his desire to help the Syrian people and to please have mercy and let him be free.
A very kind woman at the International Red Cross said, there's another New England family that's missing their journalist son, and you might like to talk to one another. That made a big difference for me, and I think for her too, because we had We understood each other's situation. And we became very close through this whole thing. Diane Foley and I used to say, you know, when they get out, they are going to be such good buddies because they're both from northern New England and they love the outdoors and they're both teachers and writers.
A photo of smiling James Foley.
You know, they're going to be friends forever.
I said, please, I need water, and they laughed. Please, I need to go to the bathroom, they laughed. You know, and when they came into the cell, they would just kick me. They would throw my food at me. I was too afraid to knock on the door to go to the bathroom. I went pee over here. And they beat the shit out of me for that. I would ask them, you know, can you give me another cellmate? Because I was in there for 3 months by myself, like all day, every day, at first, just staring at the walls. And can I talk to somebody? I'll give me another prisoner.
They open the door.
60 minutes overtime.
And this guy shoots up. And his beard's out to here, and he's dirty. And Muhammad's just like, Ameriki, like you.
35-year-old photographer Matthew Shrier says Al-Qaeda grabbed him in Syria as he tried to tell the story of Syrian rebels through pictures.
Yeah. Theo watches the footage.
You know, we were in the same jail cell for 7 months together. He was extraordinarily hostile and aggressive, and it turned aggressive, you know, within 24 hours. He was in my face screaming at me. He would storm and rant and rave and, you know, for hours and hours and hours on end, just ranting at me. What a fucking loser I was, how fucking stupid, you motherfucker. Over and over for hours and hours and hours. And then he would cry. And then he would say, you're driving me crazy. And I'd be like, I'm sorry, but we're in the Al-Qaeda jail and Al-Qaeda guys, they're doing it to you. They're driving you crazy, not me. After maybe 4 months, they brought us from the bottom of a underground warehouse where we really had no escape options to the basement of the Department of Motor Vehicles in a little neighborhood in Aleppo called Ashar. And we found pretty quickly that we could begin to bend back some of the wires in the window. And as soon as we bent back, the first thing we go, this could work.
A beam of light shines through a tiny triangle window in a high cement wall.
When Schreier was working on this grill up here, for days on end, I would just be like this.
On hands and knees.
He'd stand on my back, and he would unweave the spokes that were in the window. After 10 days, we had removed these spokes enough so that we could try and escape.
It's Ramadan, which means they fast all day long. Nobody wants to go through that, so they sleep. So the plan was, and we wait till right before sunrise, and then we can break, because they'll be sleeping.
When it came time for him to go out, it was like maybe 5 o'clock in the morning. It was just getting light. And we both wrote out little statements to our moms. We put in our pockets so that if they killed us, they would find our bodies and know who we were. He stood on my back, and then he climbed up to the window, which was about the size of a shoebox, a small shoebox. And it took him, you know, 2-3 minutes to get his body like halfway through. You're stuck so tightly within this window. You had to stop the hyperventilation, like, and then you had to calm down, take a deep breath, and then squinch up your chest, and then you would wriggle, and you would get maybe 2 more centimeters. He was panicking. He was kicking like somebody in a swimming pool, trying to save himself from drowning. I was like, calm down, just calm down, calm down.
Both my head and then both arms through first, you know, and I Supermaned out. I just slid right out, and I was free.
After he got out, I went and fetched his belongings, and I handed them to him, and then I put my hands up, and I started pushing myself through, and he was looking at the window above, and he was going, the window, there's a window up here, and it's open. Shh.
And he's making me talk, and the plan was not to talk, because we didn't know if there were windows above us, and they were. And then he got his head through, both his arms and his head, and I started pulling him. I grabbed him, and I'm pulling him. I got my foot up against the wall, I'm pulling him as hard as I could.
Lying. I mean, this is his own version. It's all fiction. He didn't try. I mean, if he really wanted to get me out, he would have taken me like this and pulled. He would have stepped on my back because my back was caught. He would have stepped on that and, you know, he would have worked it until it got done, like I did for him.
You know, he just wasn't fitting. So I said, I was just like, I can't stay here. I was like, I gotta go.
Theo watches, his hand to his mouth.
And he was like...
Matt presses his lips together.
Come back. And I said, I can't come back. And I said, I'll get help.
I put myself in danger to help him. When it was time to help me, he didn't put himself on the line. He just ran away. You know, you can't blame him, really. Anyway. I was so close, you know. I was so fucking close.
Theo leans on the wall below the window.
Things could not have gone well for him.
No.
Once they figured out you were gone.
No. And I think about it every day.
I thought they were gonna come later on and kill me. At the end of the day, they came in and they go, where's the other one? Where's the other one? I go, oh, he left. Ura, he left. Whack, over my head.
He hits the wall with a shoe.
I got up off the ground after the chains and the cables and stuff, and he goes, reenact this escape. So I reenacted in such a way that I was not here helping Schreier. I was over there by the door. I was banging on the door. Nobody came. I said, I want to be released with my honor. I don't want to go out like a rat. I want to be, you know, judge before judge. I didn't do anything wrong. Then the commander asked, how did he get up to the window? I said, he built a ladder out of t-shirts. One of the soldiers goes, where's the ladder? And the commander goes, he took it with him. I said, yes, he took it with him. I couldn't walk for several days after this beating. But, you know, 2-3 days later, I could walk. And I'm like, well, he's out there trying to get me released, and this is good. I'm happy he's gone, because I hated him. I got a nice Palestinian in my jail cell. He killed his uncle. You know, he was a nice murderer. And everything was good.
The FBI agent called me and said, we have proof of life. And I, you know, I've watched enough movies, I knew what proof of life meant.
Nancy called me and she said, just sit down. We know where he is. There's another American who has made it to the Turkish border and who escaped.
All I knew was Al-Qaeda was holding him, a branch of Al-Qaeda that I'd never heard of. And then Matt Schreier calls me. And it was clear to me that he was in a lot of distress. He kept apologizing to me for leaving Theo. I feel so bad, I'll never be able to forget hearing him call after me, Matt, don't leave me. Just pull me a little harder. I know I can get out. Please, don't do that. Don't run away. I thought, you know, I don't want to hear this. Don't tell me this. Your guilt is not my problem. I didn't say that to him. Because I felt bad for the guy.
I was in the same cell after Schreier escaped for 3 weeks, and I was under the impression that Schreier was at home showing everybody on Google Maps where Theo is. He's here. I thought that the CIA was on a rescue mission. Well, evidently they weren't. For which I don't really blame them, by the way. I mean, the CIA can't go running around
rescuing every dumb American that gets himself in trouble in the Arab world. It's up to the dumb Americans not to get themselves in trouble.
A newspaper article with Matt's picture. American sees dark side of Syrian rebels.
Matt Schreier was interviewed by the New York Times.
In the article, cellmate agreed, tried to escape.
The cousins realized that this was dangerous for Theo.
We were so concerned about how Theo's role in Matt's escape would be received by his captors, and very worried that it would have further imperiled his life.
Al-Qaeda people, the way they don't read the New York Times. However, on the Arabic TV, they do a media review summary, and they often say, such and such thing happened and was written about in the New York Times. So it's conceivable they could have gotten wind of what had happened through watching, you know, Arabic TV. Or they could have watched CNN, which they get over there.
They shot right out.
But it wasn't as easy for the other American, who we're not naming, for his safety.
Except it's on the screen.
At the bottom of the screen, it reads, Theo Curtis, imprisoned together.
Crazy.
After 3 weeks, they came. They were like in a very grim and dour mood. They just open the door and they go, Todd, come, Todd, like that. You lied to us. About what? Come here. And they just walked up to me and just, like Rodney King. And please. The commander goes, no, please. He's really calm. No, please.
A photo of a smiling, bearded man in a polo shirt.
He has this attitude, like, while the violence is going on, he's like, stop. Carry on. I'm like, please. No, please. After the chains and the cables and stuff, they put me in that room with no ventilation and no light. And it was like 120 degrees in there.
A closet-sized cinder block room.
They bound me hands and legs, and I couldn't stand up. You know, I had to just lie on the ground because my legs were cuffed too tightly together. 45 days like that. Even the other Jabhat al-Nusra guys were like, man, that's tough. Why are they doing like this, dude? And the other guys were, we don't know. Orders. After 45 days, they brought me to a heat box out in Deir ez-Zor.
A military helicopter flies in low. Camouflaged trucks and tanks sit on the scrubby hillside. Theo pulls a metal door closed on a cinder block cell. He looks out the small opening at head height.
I was 200 days in this cell.
There are four cells side by side. The top is covered by a chain link fence.
I counted them one by one. I mean, you don't have much else to do. I had to sleep like this.
He lies down on his side.
Diagonally like this. In the daytime, I would sit on this wall sometimes, and then I'd go, oh, it's noon. I better go sit on that wall. Like that. Sometimes I go, oh, I think I'll go over to the south corner. Oh, I'll go to the north corner. I tried to, like, laugh and be funny with myself about it. I don't know.
Feet move outside. He sits, back against the wall, head lowered.
The guards, part of their strategy is to reduce you to absolute nothing. You know, you're dependent on them for... There was a time when I was dependent on them for the air that I breathed because there was no ventilation in the room. In fact, they could really shut it down, so you're using up the oxygen in the room, and I needed them to crack the door just a tiny little bit. I needed them to give me water. I needed them for food, for the bathroom, everything. And, you know, when they don't give you anything for a really long time, they give you a tiny little bit, like an olive. You know, you're grateful for that olive. And then they come in and they give you five olives. You're like, thank you, man. That was really good of you. On another time, they gave me some oranges, and I took the leaves off the orange stems, and I put them in the holes in the mortar. And, you know, I called this my garden. Whenever the guards would come by, I'd say, do you want to see my garden? Do you want to sit in my garden? They would always laugh. I mean, they're just young men.
Footage of the rebels.
It was as if young men suddenly got a clubhouse in the neighborhood. And there's TV in the clubhouse, and there's tons of food, whatever you want. They didn't necessarily have this before. And the keys to Toyota Hilux and guns, and, you know, they had important prisoners to take care of and secrets and people to beat the shit out of and torture. I mean, the guys in Jebediah are having a great time, except that they get killed every once in a while. But most of them are having fun. There's a lot of fun in the jihad. It's very underrated in the West. I don't blame them exclusively because they themselves have been the victims of persecution and suffering. And, you know, they have been treated like dirt for very long. And their own siblings and parents no doubt have perished in the war. So it's a cycle of just hatred. And I refuse to capitulate to that or to participate in any way. There was one guy named Abu Hamza. I liked him. This guy, he made a special effort for me. He brought me tuna. And he could speak a little bit of English. He was always watching, like, American movies and telling me about the movies he saw. One day he came into my cell, he goes, Robert De Niro, is he Jewish? I go, Italian, I think he's Italian. He wanted to work at the UN afterwards. I said, I'll find you a job at the UN, just let me go. And he's like, I'm gonna work on it. Before I leave Deir ez-Zor, I will get you out of jail.
A pale sun hangs over trees and a snow-covered field.
We were contacted by an interlocutor, and he said he had news of Theo and was ready for a deal.
Abu Hamza was freelancing. We learned subsequently, I mean, he was calling up some contacts of his in Jordan, and they were calling up the U.S. Embassy, and the U.S. Embassy said, all right, we can put you in touch with Nancy if you'd like.
And they only wanted to deal with the United States government. Well, they didn't have an option. It's very clear. The United States government does not negotiate and does not pay ransom. So they had to keep talking to us.
My mom wanted to know that Abu Hamza actually was in touch with me. So they had Abu Hamza take pictures of me and send them to my mom.
A photo of Theo staring. His hair is pulled back. He has a scruffy beard.
And then they asked a proof of life question.
One of them was, where is your car?
It was in the basement of my mom's barn in Vermont.
Where did your grandfather teach?
How did his uncle die? One night, they brought me out of this cell into the guards room, and they asked me these questions, and it seemed like Abu Hamza was chatting on Skype to somebody in the States. He was laughing and chatting and laughing and chatting. And meanwhile, I was with another guard named Abdurrahman, and we were watching suicide videos.
The first sum was put out there, starting at $5 million and then to 5 million euros. Oh, I really meant 5 million euros, because I need a commission, is what he had said.
We did make an offer. We had an opening bid.
She twists her fingers together and rubs her palm.
I had an idea of what I could afford, and I wasn't going to sell my house or, bankrupt my family because I've got other people to worry about. Because I thought it was simply a matter of arriving at a mutually agreeable price.
Abu Hamza suddenly closed the computer. He goes, oh, time to go back to your cell. Tomorrow, he was like, it'll be 2 days, 2-3 days, and then off you go. He closed his computer, and I went back to my cell, and he vanished. What happened to Abu Hamza? I kept asking Abdurrahman, the guy with whom I was watching the suicide videos. And he goes, just because you don't see him doesn't mean he's not here. You don't see God, does that mean he's not here? I go, no, of course God is here, and Abu Hamza is here too. But I knew he was gone.
He stands in the cell.
For me, it was like I was in the middle of the ocean, and I would see a rescue boat. I could see it, and it was coming closer, and then I would blink and it would disappear.
The Vermont house is dwarfed at the end of a long, snow-covered road.
There was no follow-up. I don't know what happened. Then I had to worry about How are they treating him? When, you know, are they? I knew that he was being tortured. What were they going to do with him? What next? What's going to happen? Why do they want this person? I think mealtimes were hard.
She sautés onions.
Because that's always been in our family a time of celebration. Every time I was having a wonderful meal or being with friends, I felt, you know, here I am, and it's such a beautiful day, and I'm with these wonderful people, and we're eating such a good meal, and Theo can't be doing that. And that's when I would be really sad.
Hands on her hips, she gazes out a window.
If you had to live in this jail cell for 200 days with no sense of ever possibly maybe getting out, it's like being buried alive. You know, and you try to remind yourself, I'm still alive, I'm still alive. I'm not dead yet. One day, I fell over on the ground. I couldn't get up. I'm just like, I'm a ruined person. I have no physical strength. I have no mental strength. I just started to cry on the ground. I just missed home and freshness and fruit and love. I mean, I so much missed affection, human affection between people, because I hadn't had this for so long. It was strange. It was something that I wanted to, like, burrow into in my mind. So I did this by writing.
In Vermont, clear water moves swiftly between snowy banks over large rocks and under a bridge.
Events and people and places came to me, and suddenly I was writing a novel. I set the whole thing in Vermont. When I think of home, this is what I think of.
He walks down a dirt road.
This house right here, these woods, this barn.
At a wooden table, he sorts through pages of tiny script.
At first, they would give me like one of these pieces of paper a week. And they would give me like one pen, you know, a week. So I would run out of pen, and I would run out of ink, and I would run out of paper. So I had to write really small. But anyway, these are like, they would, my guard would go in and steal paper from the Al-Qaeda printer. And he would give me these, this is like computer paper from the Al-Qaeda computer. I would take this and fold it up into fourths, and I had a cargo pants, so this would go on the side of my cargo pants. Whenever I went anywhere, I carried this with me. It was like I rescued something from the disaster of 2 years, and it was this story. The Al-Qaeda guys, they had never seen anybody writing this much. They were curious about what the hell was going on in my cell. They kept poking through their heads to the food hatch. They would say, what are you writing? I would say, well, I'm writing a story. What is it about? Let me read to you. When I was 16, my girlfriend, who was known in our town as the pretty daughter of the local cult leader, burned down the village church.
Wearing a backpack, Theo runs to a white church.
My captors, they would, like, stare at me. My gosh, in Islam, you know, we're not allowed to attack any churches.
He pulls out lighter fluid.
They would tell us the next thing. I said, my girlfriend was a thoughtful arsonist. She laid down a little display of lollipops because it was Valentine's Day. She lit a match. Then waited a moment to see that all was well and climbed into my car.
He watches as flames lick at white siding.
When I had them in the spell of my story, you know, when they were really listening, the effect on them was like sleep on the characters in Macbeth. It knitted up the raveled sleeve of care. It was balm for hurt minds. It soothed the poison out of them. It calmed them the fuck down. It was 50-50 if I was gonna live or die. So I was not creating this book in order to publish it. I was creating it to have something to do today. And hopefully to put me to sleep at night so that I could anticipate doing something the next day. I was grateful that the Creator, God, has endowed all of us with this ability to tell stories.
In the middle of a snowy field, he gazes at the burning single wall mock-up of the church.
Pretty. They wanted me to cut to the dirty parts. They wanted me to get to, where do you have sex with her? But I included that, believe me, it's in here. It's in here because that is something I was interested in, something they were interested in, I think the world's interested in. So I put the, not really dirty, but romance and love leading to sex. I put that in my book. And in Islam, oftentimes that leads to punishment. So I put that in here too. Gypsy has her blindfold on. They're two kids, 10-year-old kids with cables in their hands. Nando has a cable in his hand.
He walks in a meadow between birch trees.
You are under arrest, do you understand? She takes off her blindfold. I say, kneel. She goes, what?
What? He cracks a whip.
You hit her on the back of the neck like this. She falls forward on her knees. This is an investigation. What? She's screaming. They go, don't scream. She screams, don't scream.
Grimacing, he wields the whip with full force against the ground. He stands in the mock-up cell.
One time I had a little plastic zip tie. I could inch my zip tie around like this and undo the little clasp here. And I was gonna escape going like this, like that. But if I had escaped then, I would have just gone straight to ISIS. Because at that point, like half of Deir ez-Zor was ISIS. The other half was different than this was. You know, after a while, some of the guards that were nicest to me, they stopped coming to my jail cell. They stopped giving me my food. I'm like, I would ask my other guards, where's Abu Omar? And they wouldn't say. And the next day, where's Abu Omar? Next day, wouldn't say. And finally, they would say, Stashid, he's been martyred. Who killed him? Oh, Islamic State. And one day, the big sheikh, Abu Maria, came by. I knew he was a very important man because all the other guards stopped talking. You know, he looks like a sheikh. He's very elaborate, long hair. He moves very slowly. I'm the leader of Al-Qaeda in Syria. And we are Al-Qaeda, and I'm the leader of Al-Qaeda. Do you understand who I am? I go, leader of Al-Qaeda. He goes, we're going to Daraa, across the desert. Wherever I go, you'll go. You're with me now. I said, Alhamdulillah, praise God.
A magenta sun creeps over the horizon.
In the morning, like 60 cars lined up at the edge of the desert. There's 200 of us. Everybody's got tons of ammunition, suicide belts, grenades. Like, we had bags of grenades in our car. After the dawn prayer, Abu Maria walked to the front of his army with a handgun and fired in the air, and we're gone.
A long caravan of cars, trucks, and tanks moves through smoke-filled air.
As we were leaving, I happened to notice people in handcuffs, which is a sure sign of them being prisoners, and they were led into a truck. That afternoon, that truck disappeared over one of these sand dunes. When it came back, it was empty. Yeah, I didn't ask any questions.
Roads and wind trails scar the dune. Theo rides in the bed of a truck.
We had to leave Deir ez-Zor because for months, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the ISIS commander, had been fighting with his best childhood friend, Abu Muriya al-Kahtani, the Jabhat al-Nusra commander. They had had a little fight over oil, the oil revenues. They had pitched their armies against one another, and the army that was holding me, Jabhat al-Nusra, had lost this battle. We fled into the desert, basically in the middle of the night, with all of our belongings and ISIS at our heels. Among the things that Jabhat al-Nusra valued the most in this world were 8 or 10 shopping bags stuffed full of cash, and these went in the car with the Sheikh, and I went in the car with the Sheikh. Every day, whenever I had an opportunity to speak to him, I would, you know, I would try to keep quiet and adopt a submissive and interested posture, which I was interested in the grievances of an al-Qaeda leader. I wanted to hear them. The first thing he told me was, ISIS makes me very sad. Makes me very sad. Because they had killed a lot of his best friends from the jihad in Iraq, and perhaps before that in Afghanistan. It's difficult to be an al-Qaeda leader. It's like his wife and kids are in some faraway country. They could be arrested at any moment. The U.S. is trying to kill him with aerial drones. He couldn't really unburden himself of his sorrows in front of the other people, but when we were alone in the truck, he could talk openly. So he would tell me about his troubles with ISIS. He would tell me about his troubles with the U.S. government, how nobody understood him. You know, he was fighting on behalf of the Syrian people. He loved the religion of Islam. He loved that Mormon violence. He had been in jail for 4 years with the American government. They had oppressed him. And I was like, Abu Maria, you know, my sheikh, I'm very sorry to hear that you have all these troubles. Please explain more. Really, I had Joseph in the Bible in mind. Joseph was taken out of the prison and he was allowed to talk to the Pharaoh. So that, and the reason why the Pharaoh loved Joseph was because Joseph could interpret his dreams.
A camel grazes on the sparse ground. The road stretches through the dunes. Theo walks along the crest of a dune at sunset.
Abu Maria told me to introduce myself to strangers as a Irish suicide bomber. I was Mustafa al-Irlandi, and I had come to Syria in order to blow myself up and help the revolution. And that way I wouldn't have to talk to people because I was supposed to be like in a state of grace before my death. He wanted them to ask me questions. But everybody in our army, after a few days, knew that I was a journalist. But they felt that I was like a respectable, decent journalist because I had the favor of the Sheikh. I spoke to them about the things that we have in common. I respect the religion of Islam. I respect their right to religious freedom, and conscious of the fact that the Syrian government has persecuted people that they deem to be too religious. I am sympathetic to their claims of victimhood at the hands of the Americans. What business did we have in Iraq? I really don't support anything that we did in Iraq, not an instant. And I could speak to them for hours about this. So, and I, in fact, know the injustices that we committed better than they do. So I could recite chapter and verse in a way they couldn't. They found me a persuasive, I think they found me, you know, as somebody who advocated for their point of view better than they can. And that's why this guy, Abu Maria, liked me. And I said, and by the way, I can do this in Washington if you just let me go. And he goes, so he said, okay, we'll let you go, we'll let you go. Just give us a few days. They kept saying, it's coming, soon. But I didn't really believe them.
The truck continues down a long blacktop road.
The last day that we were in the desert was a really stressful day because the planes came very close. Bashar al-Assad's Air Force was bombing us. ISIS was chasing us. When we finally pulled into this villa, it was this enormous, gorgeous, lovely villa with a huge banner saying Tanzim al-Qaeda, Bilad al-Sham.
Theo sits on cushions in a bright room. A black flag with white lettering hangs on the wall.
Within 5 minutes, we're all asleep because we were so exhausted and we knew we were in a safe place.
A light breeze blows a curtain.
I kept asking, like the mid-level guys, when am I going? When am I going? When am I going? And they would point to the cash bags and they'd go, look, they need the cash. You know, for falafel, it costs nothing, but they needed to buy Kalashnikovs and RPGs and God knows what else. They said, oh, the French government paid 20 mil for these people. What's Obama's problem? I go, he's an unbeliever. What are you going to do? Him out. In this time, I wasn't really in jail. You know, I had, like, jobs to do, and I would prepare the tea for them and, I don't know, clean up their dishes. I was like their house boy. They would have me, like, clean up their guns, and I would take the bullets out of the bandolero things, and clean the bullets, and put them back in. I worried that I had crossed over the line into aiding and abetting terrorism, and that when I got home, I was going to have to pay for this. One morning, I cleaned up. They all crashed out in the TV room. TV's going. I packed up all the trash. One fighter on the ground, he saw me going out in the courtyard. He goes, where are you going? I go, I'm just going out to deliver the trash shift to the courtyard. He goes, okay. I came back in. I sat down on my bed. I waited 15 minutes for him to sleep. There was nothing moving in there. Made sure I had my knob with me. I started running like a madman.
His shadowy figure goes out the door. He runs past damaged buildings.
Free. Holy shit, they're coming. Finally, I got to the hospital. I said, I'm an Irish journalist. Some people have kidnapped me. They're bad people. They're very religious. I don't know who they are. I said, I need to call my office. BBC in London. They go, BBC good, BBC very good. Just sit tight. Okay. And 10 minutes later, he opens the door. He goes, come here. And I stood up and I walked out into the hallway, and then all the Jabhat al-Nusra guards were out there with black faces, their Kalashnikovs like this.
Masked men hold weapons in front of them. One shakes his finger.
They brought me back to the villa. Threw me on the carpet in front of Abu Maria. You are a traitor. You're a lying Zionist American, and I will kill you with my own hand. We made a video right then.
I have 3 days, and you're in 3 days to live. 3 days. If you don't do anything, I'm finished. I'm dead. They will kill me.
I tried not to contemplate what could happen. What's the point of thinking that your son might die?
What happened next is always really hard to speak about, because it's such an incomprehensible tragedy.
This is James Wright Foley,
a video,
an American citizen of your country. As a government, you have been at the forefront of the aggression towards the Islamic State.
A man in a mask holds a knife.
You have plotted against us and gone far out of your way to find reasons to interfere in our affairs. Today, your military air force is attacking us daily in Iraq. Your strikes have caused casualties among Muslims.
In her kitchen, Nancy drops an egg into water.
I was in the kitchen, and the phone rang. It was Amy. Nancy, it's not good news.
I was sitting in a room with maybe 6 or 8 Al-Qaeda sheikhs, and I had the remote control, and I was flipping through, and I saw a guy with an orange jumpsuit and a man behind him in black. And then I saw American journalist. I could tell that the guy was handcuffed. I said, shit, I better change the channel. I don't want to give these guys any bad ideas. I changed the channel, same image. Changed the channel, same image. Everywhere, same image. So I'm like, shit.
Any attempt by you, Obama, to deny the Muslims their rights of living in safety will result in the bloodshed of your people.
Nancy, Jim has been beheaded. And I just sat down on the floor. I collapsed on the floor and cried. It was one of the first times that I cried. I was so shocked. I was so unprepared. And the Foleys were, if anybody was going to get out, the Foleys were so organized and working so hard. I just could not believe it. I just could not believe it. It was the end of the world. And I was no longer in the dead zone.
A photo of the Foleys speaking to the press. They hold a picture of James.
The Al-Qaeda people love to see somebody sticking their finger in the eye of the American government. And they were happy that they had me to tell, listen, this is what is going to happen to you if your government keeps on behaving this way towards the Muslims. And I knew that it was going to be a big deal in America because I knew that Americans don't really like to watch their own sons having their heads cut off for no reason in a desert in Syria.
Jim's brother Michael.
The United States could have done more on behalf of the Western and American hostages over there. And I really, really, really hope that in some way Jim's death pushes us to take another look at our policy to terrorists and hostage negotiations and rethink that.
And after that, things began to move very swiftly.
Theo rides past a tank.
I got a call from the FBI agent who had been working, holding my hand and working with me for 22 months. Nancy, what's Theo's shoe size? And at that point, I went up quite a bit because I knew the FBI is so cheap, they weren't going to spend money on shoes unless it was something real was going to happen.
In a van, Theo rides past a herd of horses on a high, curving road. Words appear. Golan Heights, Israel. He stands in a field in a bulletproof vest.
We drove to a little spot in the road where there was two UN trucks. They were standing right here, over here in front of this gate, by that bulldozer over there. To the chief of Al-Qaeda, he goes, don't say anything bad about me in the media. I said, I'll just tell the truth.
Theo carries the vest and walks to a white van with open doors.
So I jumped into the UN trucks. I hid on the ground because I thought they were going to open up fire on us. I heard the Philippines say, he's with us on the radio. He's with us, he's with us. I just started crying.
A UN truck passes a sign, mortal danger, military zone.
I don't deserve this because I did this to myself. I did this to my family. And suddenly people are being nice to me and I just collapsed. Emotionally, I just collapsed. I just let it all go.
Nancy, I'm standing on top of the Golan Heights, and your son is beside me. And he can't talk to you right now because he's kind of emotional, but he'll call you later.
Theo stands silhouetted on a hill.
The reason why they released me is because there were all these mechanical gears ready to be set in motion, but the U.S. government was not allowing them to be set in motion because they really don't believe that you should in any way make any kind of concessions or deals or nothing with any of these people over here. But as soon as they cut off James Foley's head, the U.S. government said, maybe we can set one little gear in motion, and the Qataris had all this infrastructure and communications and deals ready to be made. They made them. So within a week of James Foley's death, I was here in the hands of the FBI.
a cloudy evening sky. In a tall hotel, Theo stands in a room.
The FBI agents brought me to my hotel room in Tel Aviv. They said, okay, now it would be good if you just slept in your bed tonight without going anywhere. And I turned on the TV, it said, hostage Peter Theo Curtis released. And I said, oh, that's me. And I looked at the door and I go, oh my God, that door, it's probably not locked. There's probably no guard with the Kalashnikov out there. And as soon as that thought came through my brain, I was gone.
On a busy lit street, a bus, motorcycle, and car drive past. Two women stroll past a man sleeping on the sidewalk. Couples walk hand in hand. A man runs on the beach.
I just started running down the beach. It felt like I was in a dream.
Bare feet run, digging into the sand.
My God, it was so beautiful, this beach, the water, the moon.
Men wearing yarmulkes and white shirts drink and pose for a photo on the beach.
And I didn't want to sleep. I just wanted to talk to people. I wanted contact with human beings who are normal and not part of a terrorist organization.
We were hanging out outside the hostel, just having a couple beers and some cigarettes, and next thing we knew, there was a stranger that kind of walked out of the shadows or the darkness and just approached us.
Footage from that night.
I'm free. These you people are basically the first two people that I have spoken with in English for 2 years.
And I was kind of a shock. I didn't really know what that meant. I said, what? He said, yeah, I got released from Syrian prison earlier today.
Did you come to Tel Aviv with this?
No, this is FBI gave me all this.
The clothes and all that stuff?
This entire FBI outfit.
Wow.
I'm so happy to be here with you guys.
And we're very happy you're here with us. Honestly, you're free, you do whatever you want.
He started talking to us and didn't really stop.
It's nice to meet people that, remind me of how broad the world is. You guys have beautiful futures. You can go on to be professionals or have happy lives. And I hope I don't.
All three of us. All three of us. All three of us. Cheers.
Cheers.
All of us.
Not just us.
I had slept for 2 years in Al Qaeda jail. I didn't need any more. So I brought the youth hostel crew back to my hotel room.
This is an official Al Qaeda uniform.
A long tunic.
You have to wear this because when you pray to Allah, when you go down like this, your butt goes up in the air, it's a sin. If
it shows the cross.
Yeah,
you're a plumber. At 8:30 in the morning, the FBI guys came and knocked on the door. They said, okay, it's time for you to get up. Good, the groundling. Who's that guy? And I said, oh, he's my friend from the youth hostel. That's what happened.
Gliding down a winding road through lush green foliage.
The Boston FBI people came to my house, and I already had the house was surrounded by media. I had to slip out the back door, and they drove me to Logan Airport through some back way that nobody knows exists, and we went directly onto the tarmac, and the plane came in, and Theo was ushered out, and we looked at one another, and I hugged him, and then they took some photos.
They stand side by side, smiling.
You're okay. Yeah, I'm fine. I don't think either one of us could afford a lot of emotion at that point. Everybody was so exhausted, we didn't have time for, weeping and singing and dancing. It wasn't this whole trauma is over. Just, we got through today.
Theo sits by Viva. She touches his arm. He shakes his head.
It's just hard for me. I'm going to put my
My mom, Viva, and everybody through.
Nancy cooks poached eggs. She and Theo eat together.
I was mad at the Al-Qaeda people for what they did to my mom, you know, and I wanted to tell them, you can do it to me, but you're doing it to a whole family. But they say you have done horrible things to our families. What they did to me is nothing compared to what American bombs have done to Iraqi and Syrian families now. And how do you respond to that?
A life vest floats with a piece of clothing attached. Theo and a group of people are on a rocky beach.
This is the island of Lesbos. Every day, refugees from Syria come across these straits, sometimes just a few boats, but sometimes by the dozens.
He runs into the water and helps to guide a life raft with 24 people aboard.
I came here to volunteer and to welcome them and to give them tea. That's what I'm doing. It makes me happy. Do we have other doctors? This guy needs a doctor. He has a problem in his lungs. He said there's also a problem in his heart.
And my heart?
Yeah.
Theo carries a child onto the beach. He speaks to a crowd.
Early in my imprisonment, I used to lie on the floor of my cell. I would draw the blanket up over my head.
Boston University School of Journalism.
I would think about the things that had meant the most to me. You know, what had I really loved? Well, I thought about some girlfriends that I had had. I thought about my mom.
Nancy is in the audience.
I wish that I had loved other people more and they could have caught me. I wish I had allowed myself to be loved. If only this love had anchored me to life. If we want to help Syria in general, we should be sending them sweetness and blankets and love. We should not bomb them. We should stop bombing them. Listen, I lived under those bombs for 2 years. All we're doing is we're spreading the hate, and it is not what the citizens need, and it is not what we need for ourselves. When I walked through that olive grove, Al-Qaeda had been transforming schools, hospitals, city halls, DMVs into prisons. It seemed to me that the prisons and their torture chambers had spread across the country because it had had too little love in it.
In the dark room.
There was one of these jihadis in my cell. His femur was shattered. It was like bleeding pus and blood. It was really disgusting. Can you rub my leg? He would say, okay, I would do it. I mean, the guy was in pain. What are you gonna do? I'm gonna, no, I'm busy. I wasn't busy. So like this, and he would put his leg up like this. And I had to do it. And then I would stop after 5 minutes. He'd go, that's it? That's all you're gonna do? I'd do another 5 minutes. Sometimes he'd say, can you sing to me? I would sing to him. And at those moments, you know, he was not a crazy suicidal jihadist. He was just a normal guy who loved attention and loved being treated affectionately. There was one song that he really loved to hear. Sing me that song about the cowboy. I would sing, how does it go? Don't your feet get cold in the wintertime? The sky won't snow and the sun won't shine. I would sing, you're losing all your highs and lows, and a funny high feeling goes away. Desperado, oh, you ain't getting no younger. Your pain and your hunger are driving you on. Freedom, oh, freedom. Well, that's just some people talking. You better let somebody love you. You better let somebody love you, for it's too late. That's the part he liked the most. Let somebody love you. He's like, yes.
Cut to black. Credits appear, featuring Theo Padnos, Nancy Curtis, Viva Hartig, directed by David Shiskell, screenplay by David Shiskell, produced by Amanda Branson Gill, PGA, executive producers Evgenia Peretz, Dan Kogan, editor Jane Joe, director of photography Timothy Grusha, music produced and performed by Byron Esta, production designer Knox White, credits scroll. Additional photography, Rachel Beth Anderson. Assistant editor, Ilaria Pulsanitti. Co-producer, Mark Steele. Associate producers, Sebnem Arsu, Patrick Fender, Aaron Yardeni. Art director, Tyler Howarth. Recording engineer for musical score, Rich Phyllis. Musical score recorded at Logo Studios, New York City. Supervising sound editor, Eric Offen. Special thanks, Tribeca Film Institute, Alexandria Hannibal, Jose Rodriguez, with support from TFI A&E Indie Films, Story Lab, copyright 2016, DNS Projects.